This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bianculli of the website TV Worth Watching, in for Terry Gross. Our first guest, Lucy Worsley, has written a new book about the history of the home, how such rooms as the kitchen, bedroom, and bathroom evolved into what they are today. The book is called If These Walls Could Talk, and Worsley hosted a BBC series of the same name. Worsley describes how bedrooms in the past were crowded, semi-public places and became reserved for sleep and sex only in the 19th century. The bathroom didn't even exist as a separate room until late in the Victorian age. Worsley is chief curator at Historic Royal Palaces, the charity that looks after several British palaces, including the Tower of London. She spoke with Terry last week.
Lucy Worsley, welcome to Fresh Air. So let's start with the bedroom, which you say, of course, now is a private place for sleeping and for sex. But you say bedrooms of the past were crowded, semi-public places. How far back do we have to go for bedrooms to be that?
Well, if you think about this notion that a bedroom is a private place, it really is very modern. 100 years ago, you would have been quite happy to share your bed, your bedroom, not only with your husband and wife or your brother and sister, but with your colleagues from work, for example. Think about that. Even with people that you didn't know at all. And if you look back centuries, people had no particular requirement to sleep by themselves. And that's because there weren't enough rooms in their houses. If you think about a medieval household, for example, you take a really grand, important, upscale one, then you would find all of the servants bedding down together in the great hall on the floor, and night it becomes a dormitory. And yes, it's noisy and smoky and smelly, but at least here there is company and security, and the alternative is worse.
Which is what?
Oh, to be sleeping outside, I suppose. If there aren't enough bedrooms for everybody, you've got to share. And you're glad to do so because of the warmth and the security and the comfort that it brings.
And you point out this is why fields were such romantic places, because you could get some privacy there.
Well, there was this quite interesting sleeping arrangement known as bundling, which was common in the 18th century. In rural areas of Britain, you also find it in New England. And the idea is that a young man and a young woman are going to spend the night together, but they're going to be tied down with ropes, or maybe there's going to be a big board put up the middle of the bed. And this is her parents' bed that they've been allowed to use. And the idea is they're going to spend all night chatting, just getting to know each other, to find out whether they're going to get married. And it sounds really weird, but actually it's a really sensible way of going about things, because the alternative for the girl's mom and dad was, well, she'd be off in the fields, in the lanes, you know, the merry month of May. This is the time when the young people can get out of the confines of a cottage with very few rooms and enjoy themselves. So to do it under a level of supervision was far desirable to letting the young people completely off the leash.
I'm trying to imagine being tied down to the bed with your boyfriend on the other side and a board between you. Sounds lovely. How common a practice was bundling?
Well, you just hear hints about it. But it's one of those things which is from lower down in society. So the written records just aren't as good. And you have to be like a sort of forensic examiner going through little glimpses and snippets of information, oral traditions, to find out about things like this. But I think that bundling is, I see it as a really important step, actually, along the journey into marriage becoming a matter of personal choice rather than something you're just forced into by your parents for economic reasons, because you don't have to marry the man, the woman, after the night of bundling.
You also say about the bedroom that for a lot of people, the bedroom was the room. I mean, you basically had a room to live in, and it was the everything room.
Yes, yes. If you think of the basic medieval cottage, it's just one single space. It's used for everything: cooking, any leisure, which would be very limited, sleeping, the washing that did take place, and probably working as well. And do you know a funny thing? In a way, history's gone full circle, because my modern boring flat where I live is essentially just one room, and it's multi-purpose. But between that, there's been a whole journey that houses have taken, which is to develop different rooms. Rooms have proliferated. They reached a high point, I think, in really grand Victorian houses. But now, since then, there's been a trend back towards medieval simplicity and multi-purpose rooms.
You know, one thing I kept wondering reading your book, If Walls Could Talk, is how much of the history of the home, as you describe it, applies to America. And of course, in medieval times in the U.S., the population was Native American, and their home arrangements were different than England. But once, you know, Europeans started settling the United States, do you think that their notion of home paralleled what you're describing in England?
I think that it owes a lot to the European tradition, doesn't it? You can see, and in fact, some parts of European history survive in America where they don't in the UK. For example, the Tudors invented a special new room in the house called the closet. And the closet is a lovely little room. It's richly decorated. It's private. It's off the bedchamber. And it was originally used for the storing of precious arts and treasures. And it was used for praying. It's linked to the rise of literacy. People kept their books in closets. And the Pilgrim Fathers took closets over to America. And still in your houses, that's the room where precious things are stored. But they've died out in England. We don't have closets anymore.
You don't have closets?
No, we don't. We have freestanding pieces of furniture called wardrobes that might be used for storing clothes as a piece of furniture in the room. But those little square, dark, walk-in rooms don't exist in the UK.
I didn't realize that. Okay.
That's a little piece of history that you've got that we haven't.
Right. So you say only in the 19th century did the bedroom become a secluded place for sleep and for sex and for birth and for death, because that's where usually women gave birth and it's where most people died. So what changed in the 19th century for the bedroom to become a more private place?
Well, I think we see the beginnings of this in actually middle class 18th century townhouses. This is where for the first time we see part of the plan of the house being given over to corridors, to landings, to circulation space, allowing each household member to have their own front door of their own private bedroom, if you like. At the very top of society, in royal bedrooms, there's still going to be a lot of people present, all of those servants. And right down at the bottom of society, people are still going to be sharing because they don't have the resources to provide each family member with a bedroom. But it begins to be, it comes with the beginning of the middle classes, I suppose. Those are the people who start wanting to be by themselves in bed. And this really flourishes in the Victorian age, when the purity, the seclusion of your bedroom and your bed linen becomes paramount. If you read Victorian household manuals, they're crazy, the amount of attention they devote to the perfect making of the bed, the cleanliness of the bed, the hygiene of the bed, the effort that goes into it, keeping it pure, partly because of fears of disease and partly because it's respectable. It's a proper Victorian thing to do.
We're talking about the history of the home as we know it, how the bathroom became the bedroom, and the kitchen. My guest is Lucy Worsley. She's the author of the new book, If Walls Could Talk, An Intimate History of the Home. So let's get to the bathroom. As you point out, it is the place in our home that actually has a lock on it. That's out of the front door. But it used to not be a very private place. In fact, it didn't used to be a separate place. How did people perform the functions performed in the bathroom before there was a bathroom?
Mm-hmm. Well, you really only start to get the fixed purpose bathroom in the late 19th century with the arrival of proper plumbing and drainage and taps and all that sort of thing becoming standard. Until that time, people washed parts of their bodies wherever it happened to suit them. And one of the pieces of research that I did for this book was to go for a week on a Tudor personal hygiene regime. So the rules were no bath, no shower, no toothpaste, no shampoo, no deodorant. How did they do it? And I knew that they did just use a basin of water. They would wash all the parts of the body one after another, and they would do it wherever happened to be nice and appropriate. If I'd had a servant, it would have been lovely to do it in my bedroom. The servant would have brought me in a nice bowl of warm water, and I could have done it in complete seclusion and privacy. In effect, I ended up washing myself in my kitchen because sadly I didn't have a servant to bring me the water. And so that was kind of less labour intensive way of doing it. But I could really see the advantages to be able to do it anywhere, never to have to wait for anybody else. You don't have to queue to go to the loo. And Queen Elizabeth I, for example, she had a flushing toilet fitted in one of her royal palaces. She was aware of this technology, but she didn't use it because she didn't want to have to go to the loo. She wanted the loo to come to her. She wanted her servants to bring her a chamber pot whenever she wanted to. And nobody would know where she was going or what she was doing in that case.
You said the flushing toilet was invented in the late 16th century, but it took a long time for it to catch on. What was the first flushing toilet like? Do you know?
Well, the first flushing toilet, well, at least there were drawings for it that exist in a book that was published by a man called Sir John Harrington, who was always sucking up to Elizabeth I. He's the person who's said to have installed the first flushing toilet for her in the palace at Richmond. But none of these flushing toilets actually survive. So we thought we'd recreate one according to John Harrington's instructions. And there is a tank at the bottom and the water is let out all in a big gush. And our reconstructed model was surprisingly effective. It did flush down a handful of cherry tomatoes, which is what we were using. But the problem with it is that you need drainage, really, for it to work. What do you do with the water afterwards? It needs somewhere to go.
So when did the flushing toilet catch on?
Well, you begin to hear more and more examples being mentioned in the 18th century, and there are lots of different technical things that need sorting out, like the valve and the flush and the drainage. But it's really in the 19th century when London gets its proper drainage system for the first time. And that is connected to the massive deaths through cholera, which eventually people work out is a waterborne disease. And it's because the dirty water is getting mixed up with the clean water. And eventually, that's why, in London at least, Sir Joseph Bazalgette builds his enormous network of sewers that we've still got. They're still in use today.
A man by the name of Thomas Crapper had a role in the modernization of the toilet. What was his role? I mean, he has that name that makes you makes
yes,
you think about coincidence. but the name's totally coincidental, right?
I fear that it is. What Sir Thomas Crapper, complete coincidence, does is not invent the flushing toilet, as many, many people believe, but he was a great promoter for it. He ran a business marketing other people's plumbing parts, and so that's why his name appeared on so many people's cisterns in so many people's homes. And when the American soldiers came over in the First World War, they saw these toilets and they thought it was hilarious that they all said Crapper on them, but it's a bit of a coincidence, I'm afraid.
Let's talk a little bit about the kitchen, which is now associated with family and nourishment, and it's like the heart of many homes. But you say it used to be kind of separated from the home. Why and how?
Well, I think the kitchen's been on a really interesting little journey from the center of the house and then outside and then back in again. It seems to have gone full circle. If you think about a medieval peasant's cottage, right at the very center of it would have been the hearth stone upon which the fire was built. And over it, you would hang your round bottomed iron pot. And this created the mainstay of the medieval diet. Pottage made in a pot. You throw in anything you've got, grain, vegetables, meat, if you're lucky. You keep it on the go for day after day after day. And so that was the very center of that way of living. As people get more genteel, better off, they have more leisure time, they have aspirations, they don't want that sight and sound and smell of cooking. So they push it out, ideally, in the 18th century, really grand mansion house, to another building quite separate from the house altogether. In the 19th century, what happens is that there's a shortage of space in cities. It's no longer feasible to have a separate outhouse kitchen, so it gets pushed down into the basement. And then in the 20th century, with the whole collapse of the infrastructure of domestic servants, once you can't have your own cook anymore, and this really starts to bite in the 1930s and the 1940s, after that, then it's like householders go back into their own kitchens for the first time since the medieval period, and it becomes the heart of the home once again, like you say. I think it's probably the room that many people will consider most important in their house.
But this sounds very much like it's a class thing. Like if you're upper class and you have servants, then the kitchen is separated from the home. But if, you know, if you're just a family early, you know, in the era that you're talking about, you're not going to have a separate kitchen and a separate place, are you?
No. If you were lower down in society, I guess you would just go on doing your own cooking. It would still be the center of your home. But, you know, a lot of people didn't have their own homes in the past because they were living in these much, much larger units, the great household. If you think of Downton Abbey, for example, you can see there's a lot of young people living there in that sort of communal situation.
Because they're working as servants?
Yeah, exactly, because the economy just prioritizes domestic service. Their wages are cheap enough for people just to employ them. And this is a great sort of inhibitor to the invention of labor-saving devices and gadgets and machines right up until the 20th century. It's just cheaper to get someone to do the job for you.
Now, I'm interested in your job as chief curator of historic royal palaces in England. And Historic Royal Palaces is the charity that runs the royal palaces that are not actually being used by the royals. So they've basically become museums. So do the castles that you help oversee, do they have rooms that didn't exist in other homes ever? You know, like...
Yes, I think that would be fair to say, because a royal palace is generally going to be the most lavish and complicated building of its age. And the king or queen has so many rooms that on the face of it, he, she doesn't really need. But actually, they're essential to the image, the charisma of the king. So, for example, in a royal palace, you'll get a whole suite of rooms. You'll go up a really impressive grand staircase just to intimidate you. And then you'll have to pass through the guard chamber, where the royal guards will be. Then you might move on to the presence chamber, the withdrawing chamber, the dining chamber. Only then will you get to the king or queen's bedchamber at the end of this whole sort of great suite of rooms. And they act like a sieve. Each successive doorway is like a filter. And if you are not rich enough or important enough or well-dressed enough, the guards at the door won't let you in. So it's like a process of filtering out the people who aren't good enough to meet the king or queen and only letting those very special people right the way through into the royal presence.
The castles represent like quite an achievement in architecture. They're amazing historic windows into the past, but they're also relics of incredible inequity. Where, the king and the queen had this royal palace while so many other people had basically nothing. I know there's still a lot of inequity in this world, but the palace is really symbolic of that in some ways. Do you think about that a lot when you're working in the palaces?
I do. I think about this all the time, and I find this a really almost unanswerable question. Because, was it better in the past or not? Clearly, in many ways, no, it was worse in the past because there was hierarchy. But if you think about the way in which medieval society was conceived, there was this incredibly detailed and rigid hierarchy that goes down from God to the king, to people like dukes, to noblemen, then to gentry, to yeomen, to peasants, and it goes right down to the plants and then the stones at the very bottom. Everybody knows where they fit in. But there is an argument that if you know where you fit in, your expectations are managed and you will never be disappointed. And another advantage to the hierarchy is that those at the top have responsibilities towards those at the bottom that just don't exist today. Now that there's much more of an idea of every man for himself, make of yourself what you will, the traditions of charity and community, I do think, were valuable in medieval life. But at the same time, you've got to balance that against the lack of freedom, the way that everybody would have looked down on you if you tried to get out of your allotted station in life. I don't know. It's really interesting trying to see what we can learn from the past.
The palaces are relics of another time, but there still is a royal family in England. Do you ever ask yourself why?
Oh, I don't really, because I think that they're a very good thing indeed. I'm interested in them as a historian, as a piece of living history, if you like. They're terribly important to people's notions of Britain and Britishness, and they're a really big part of the tourist industry as well. All of those processions, the regalia, the crown jewels, they're just essential to our conception of who we are over here, I think.
Do you get to meet the royal family working as a curator of the palace?
We do from time to time because they do support the charity. In fact, in a week or so's time, the Queen is coming to visit the new rooms at Kensington Palace, which are just about to be reopened. We've had this huge representation project going on, which reopens on the 26th of March. So she's going to come along and hopefully see what we've done and hopefully like it. I should be back there at the moment. Everybody's hanging the paintings on the walls. It's the final phases.
What's the protocol for your behaviour when you meet her?
Well, it is correct, if you wish to follow correct etiquette, to give a little curtsy as you meet the Queen. And then,
I've never had to do that. I've never had the honor of meeting the Queen. Does it feel odd to do a curtsy in 2012?
Yeah, I guess that I know. It sure would do, but I've actually studied curtsies quite intensively.
Oh, really?
I've taken lessons in how to do them as part of an exhibition that we once put on. So I guess it feels less odd for me than it would do for most people. I admit, I am a freak here. I am not representative of the British people in saying this.
What kind of curtsy do you have to do? I didn't realize.
Well, if you want to do it really, if you want to do the real bee's knees of curtsy, then you do the double court curtsy. And that's to sink really down low. And the secret to it is to lock one knee behind the other. That gives you stability. If you want to try this at home, stand up, put one leg in front of the other, put one knee behind the other, and then you can sink down and you can rise up again and you won't fall over. And this is what debutantes were taught by their dancing masters to do before making their first appearance at court for many, many centuries, when becoming a debutante was the coming of age. It sort of announced to the world that you were ready to get married, and your mother would bring you to the court and introduce you to the king or queen, and you would take your place in polite society. None of this has happened since 1958. That's when the whole sort of debutante charade ended.
Gee, I never realized that a curtsy could be so complicated.
Oh, yeah. And if you wanted to attend an 18th century drawing room, it was worse than that. You had to learn never to cross your arms, never to turn your back on the king or queen, how to manage your dress, because at court you have to wear these hugely enormous wide mantuas, they were called. Can you imagine what I mean? They spread out sideways over whalebone hooped petticoats underneath. You can just fit through the broad doors of the palace, but in any normal house you'd have to turn sideways to get through. And so that's why people at court took training lessons beforehand in the correct way to stand and to bow and to get in and out of the room. It was all just weirdly fossilized.
Well, Lucy Worsley, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Lucy Worsley, speaking with Terry Gross. Worsley is the chief curator of historic royal palaces in England and author of the new book, If Walls Could Talk, An Intimate History of the Home. You can read an excerpt on our website, freshair.npr.org. In December, Columbia Records released a box set of the 19 studio albums recorded by the Dave Brubeck Quartet between 1955 and 1966. Besides such familiar titles as Time Out and Dave Digs Disney, there were a host of all but forgotten albums. A few of those are now available as download-only releases, and jazz critic Kevin Whitehead recommends a couple of them.
Drummer Joe Morello with pianist Dave Brubeck. After Brubeck signed with Columbia in the mid-1950s, his quartet made a few albums a year. By 1959, they were short of material to record, having exhausted their live repertoire. Their album Time Out, with tunes in odd meters like Take Five, would point them in a new direction, but it took that stuff a couple years to catch on. The album Brubeck made just before Time Out, Gone with the Wind, consisted mostly of moldy old tunes, many in the public domain, that the band hadn't played before. It could have been a throwaway, with trifles like Deep in the Heart of Texas, where Brubeck could get heavy-handed. But sometimes, his playing is surprisingly restrained. For me, that's Brubeck at his best. Saxophonist Paul Desmond on Stephen Foster's The Old Folks at Home, listed as Swanee River on Dave Brubeck's album Gone with the Wind. His quartet's great success was partly due to Joe Morello's flashy drumming and partly to the contrast between the exuberant Brubeck and the imperturbably serene Paul Desmond. The alto saxophonist improvised plaintively lyrical melodies with a tangy, sweet and sour tone. He and Brubeck orbited and influenced each other. Desmond wrote their splashy hit Take Five, and when he quote other tunes in a solo for sport, Brubeck might rise to the bait. Improvising on Gone with the Wind, Brubeck works in Have You Met Miss Jones, the Candid Camera theme, and a few more tunes. Dave Brubeck with Gene Wright on bass. The quartet's next and biggest album, Time Out, was partly inspired by rhythms they'd heard touring the world in 1958. After that, it was back to more Stephen Foster and such for the album Southern Scene, but with fewer sightings of Paul Desmond, who'd weary of the band occasionally. Confronting other cultures may have prompted the Travelers to reassess their own, but then other jazz musicians played Anglo-American traditional themes during the late 50s folk music boom. Brubeck's quartet would record a few albums inspired by their tours, like the classic Jazz Impressions of Japan. But the first of them was Jazz Impressions of the USA from 1956, with Brubeck's Ode to a Cowboy. The loping bassist here is Norman Bates. No jazz musician was more urbane than saxophonist Paul Desmond, who sounds as much at home on the rural sketches on Jazz Impressions of the USA as on the salutes to Broadway and the Chicago Loop. No surprise, as his tone never varies. Much as Morello's slamming could get on Desmond's nerves, the drummer and the pianist knew how to lay back and set him up. And Brubeck wrote Desmond nice vehicles like the Rolling Pastoral Summer Song. Before they were world travelers, the Brubeck Quartet crisscrossed the American continent as the toast of the college circuit. Dave Brubeck wrote Plain Song on a bus somewhere in western Iowa, and you could hear the road weariness, monotonous landscape, and ka-thunk of tires on concrete highway slabs. No wonder this busy quartet's music drew more and more on what they saw and heard on the road. It's like rockers and country singers doing songs about the Holiday Inn. You write what you know.
Kevin Whitehead is a jazz columnist for eMusic.com and the author of the book Why Jazz. He reviewed the two download-only re-releases, Gone with the Wind and Jazz Impressions of the USA by the Dave Brubeck Quartet. Coming up, John Villasenor will tell us about new FAA regulations paving the way for unmanned drones to begin flying over the U.S. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bianculli in for Terry Gross. Drones are coming to the United States. Last month, Congress passed and President Obama signed a bill that requires the Federal Aviation Administration to integrate drones into our national airspace. Though we're familiar with the Predator drones that are used to track and kill terrorists, drones also can be small and non-lethal. Public agencies such as police, fire departments, and border control can use them for surveillance, and there will also be drones operated by private companies for commercial use. Drones can monitor cell phone and Wi-Fi signals and are capable of super high resolution and video imaging. Our guest, John Villasenor, has written about some of the privacy and safety issues we will face in this new era of domestic drones. Villasenor is a senior fellow in governance studies at the Center for Technology Innovation at the Brookings Institution and a professor of electrical engineering at UCLA. He spoke with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies last week.
Well, John Villasenor, welcome to Fresh Air. You know, we think of drones as being military aircraft in use in Afghanistan and Pakistan, but they really have all kinds of uses, don't they? What are some of the uses that you might see in the United States?
Well, there's a long list of uses. For example, they're obviously very useful for providing overhead surveillance for police departments, for example. If there's some sort of a criminal, like a hostage situation going on, you can imagine it could be very useful for that. Customs and Border Protection uses them to keep watch over the border. They can be used to spot wildfires, to inspect oil pipelines, construction sites, really an almost endless list of non-military uses.
Right. And those all sound like kind of responsible things that people would, you know, undertake to maintain security and the like. What about just simple commercial uses that might arise?
Certainly that as well. For example, one application that you see sometimes is real estate firms wanting to get overhead images of a property for advertising the property as part of a home sale. And again, for things like oil pipelines and things like that, operators of oil pipelines, commercial operators might use them for those purposes as well. You can imagine them being used for surveying, for keeping an eye on traffic, really any number of applications.
Give us an idea of some of their capabilities. I mean, pictures, video, I mean, can they focus in on sounds in a particular room?
So I think by far the most significant and the capability that's most likely to be used is of course, imaging, and imaging meant to include both still pictures as well as video. I think probably second on the list, we would have wireless monitoring of radio signals, so signals from Wi-Fi access points. You could monitor cell phone conversations. You could intercept cell phone conversations and redirect them somehow. You could potentially monitor computers. You could obviously perform surveillance by taking pictures into backyards and windows and so on.
And video too, right?
Video too, yes. Anything you can do with a smartphone, you can put your smartphone on a drone and do it from a drone. And also infrared imaging. Drones could be used to monitor what rooms were certain temperatures and what in a house. They could see when lights are being turned on and off. They could follow cars. They could do all sorts of things that would be much more difficult to do without drones.
Okay. Before we get into what the new FAA rules might be and all of the legal issues that this presents, let's talk a little bit more about what kind of drones there are. And I think people are used to thinking of these as big, you know, relatively big unmanned aircraft, which can be used to, you know, take out terrorist targets in Afghanistan. But there's quite a diversity, right? Give us a sense of sort of the range in size, height at which they fly, that kind of thing.
Yeah, drone. The term drone has been used to cover what was really an extraordinary array of different, not only sizes but shapes and forms and speeds and the like. So to give some examples, there are drones that are essentially the size of business jets and, in fact, are jet-powered and that are used by the U.S. military. There are drones that are solar-powered that are very large but extremely light and can fly for months and years at a time at extremely high altitudes. There are drones that can fit literally in the trunk of a car or in a backpack or even the palm of a hand. Some of these drones can weigh 10 pounds, 5 pounds, less than 1 pound, a few ounces. And they can obviously fly in much smaller spaces and are much more agile. There are drones that are basically like balloons that sit up there in the sky in one place and can observe for long periods of time enormous swaths of territory. So there's really an enormous range of these things.
Now, you said there are also drones which fly way up high, like in the stratosphere, and are incredibly light. And did you say can stay up for weeks, months?
Yes. So there's, for example, a company, an English company called Kinetic, that has a drone that has, in a test in Arizona, and I believe it was 2010, stayed over Arizona continuously for about 2 weeks. And that drone, despite having a wingspan of over 100 feet, it weighed roughly, if I remember correctly, on the order of somewhere between 60, 70 pounds. It was very light, given its size. Boeing, the aerospace and defense giant, has been awarded a contract to develop something called the Solar Eagle, which is designed to be able to fly for 5 continuous years at a time at stratospheric altitudes. And so we're talking, 50, 60, 70,000 feet. And these airplanes, these drones aren't flying at 400 miles per hour. These are going very slowly, and they have wings which are paper thin, which have solar panels mounted on the top, and they also have batteries to store energy collected during the day so they can continue to turn the propellers and fly at night and until the sun comes up.
And what would they do at that height? You said 60,000 feet?
Yes. Yeah, so, for example, at 60,000 feet, you can survey an absolutely enormous amount of territory. And so drones at that height would presumably have not one camera, but probably a whole array of cameras mounted on the underside, and would be able to then perform surveillance of hundreds of square miles or even more from that vantage point. And then, of course, they would send all that information down through a wireless link to some station on the ground.
Now, we already have these satellites, which have enormous resolution cameras in them. What could the drones do that the satellites wouldn't?
Satellites have high-resolution cameras, but they're much farther away. Even the lowest of the low-orbit satellites or the satellites that dip down to low points in their orbit, they're never lower than roughly 100 miles above the Earth's surface. Now, that's low for a satellite, but now we compare that with a drone that's at 60,000 feet, you're talking something that's closer to 11 or 12 miles. So because these drones are basically about one-tenth as far away as the satellites, then an equivalent camera is, of course, going to give you much higher resolution. So being closer will make these drones in a position to image in much more detail.
And, of course, a satellite orbits the Earth, but a drone could conceivably hover over its target, right?
That's exactly right. The only time a satellite can hover over one spot on Earth is if it's in what is called a geostationary orbit, which is over 20,000 miles away. And that's great for communication satellites, but not very good for surveillance. And as you said, that's exactly right. The satellites that are in low orbits, they move around. They don't stay in one spot, whereas one of these stratospheric drones could turn slow circles in the sky and, in effect, be stationary with respect to one area on the ground.
Right, so let's talk about what's happened now with the FAA, the Federal Aviation Administration. In a funding bill in February, right, there was new language which required the FAA to address the issue of unmanned aerial vehicles, right?
Yes, that's right. There's a not very long but a very important section in that bill.
And what does it provide?
It provides a complex set of overlapping stages to bring drones into the domestic airspace system. But the upshot is that there's some deadlines and we're going to have increasing amount of drones, which, will in the sort of the end game is the goal is to have by, I believe it's September 30th, 2015, to have what the FAA terms the, quote, safe integration of civil unmanned systems, unmanned aircraft systems into the national airspace system. But there's a whole set of steps that occurs on the way to September 30th, 2015 to enable that to happen.
But is the intent to essentially permit commercial use of drones in the United States, provided it can be done safely?
That is part of the intent. The bill really addresses two classes of what are in formal terms called unmanned aircraft systems, or UASs, which we refer to as drones. There are civil unmanned aircraft systems, and then there are public unmanned aircraft systems. And public is basically the word for police departments, fire departments, state government agencies, the national government. And then civil unmanned aircraft systems would be drones operated, for example, by private companies. And the bill provides, in separate language and in separate terms, the bill provides for both of those types of drones.
Let's talk about some of the issues raised by the presence of possibly hundreds or thousands of drones flying around the United States. I mean, one question obviously is privacy. If they have the ability to take pictures just about anywhere in the air, I mean, it can be intrusive. I mean, it can be paparazzi. It could be people, shadowing or stalking a girlfriend or a boyfriend. What's the current law on the extent to which you're allowed to take pictures from the air?
There's a really interesting and highly relevant Supreme Court case from 1986. And what happened then was there was a police department which used a private airplane, one of these small single-engine airplanes, to fly over a suspect's house and observed that in the backyard the suspect was growing marijuana. And the suspect was arrested, and the suspect challenged that on the grounds that that was an unreasonable search in violation of the Fourth Amendment. And that went all the way up to the Supreme Court, which in May of 1986 issued a ruling which said that that was not an unreasonable search, and because the police observations took place within what they called public navigable airspace in a physically non-intrusive manner, that that was permitted and within the scope of the Fourth Amendment. Now, if you take that ruling and you apply it to a world in which there are hundreds or thousands of drones, then that obviously gives rise to some very significant concerns.
Yeah, that seems to fit exactly what a drone can do, public navigable airspace in a physically non-intrusive manner. I mean, does that mean the paparazzi have a free shot?
Well, this will certainly get tested. If you interpret that ruling all by itself, that would certainly suggest that at least as things stand today, people will have a fair amount of latitude to make observations from using drones. But there are other very interesting and relevant cases as well, which relate not to drones, but to the observation from outside of what is happening inside. One case that's really also very interesting and perhaps relevant is a 2001 ruling in a case called Kylo versus the United States, again by the Supreme Court. And in that case, what had happened was the police had used an infrared detector, not from an airplane, but just from the ground, and had used that to observe that the walls of a house were warmer than they should be. And they inferred from that that there were marijuana plants growing inside. And that was challenged in the Supreme Court. In that case, in fact, ruled against the government. And in that case, the government, was found to have violated the Fourth Amendment. And there's a very interesting piece of language in that ruling, which when you map it to drones, is really interesting. I'll read a single sentence from the ruling in that Supreme Court case. Where, as here, the government uses a device that is not in general public use to explore details of the home that would previously have been unknowable without physical intrusion, the surveillance is a search. So then went on to say that that's an unreasonable search without a warrant. And so one of the interesting phrases in that language is not in general public use. And so then if we fast forward for two or three or four years from now, when drones are in public use, does that change the legal foundation for what you can and can't observe from the outside of a home that would have been previously unknowable without physical intrusion?
So we have this new interesting language in federal law, which requires the FAA to permit the safe integration of drones into American airspace by the fall of 2015. And as you've explained, there are many intermediate steps. But what kind of a world could we be living in 5 years? I mean, will you go outside and see drones?
I don't think that in 5 years when you step outside the grocery store and look up into the sky, you will see dozens of drones swarming above you. But I do think that if you look carefully from certain vantage points, you will see drones more and more. So, for example, one of the things that I'm sure many people have seen is when there's a traffic problem, a tie-up on an interstate highway or a freeway, very often you know there's a tie-up because you can see three or four traffic helicopters, hovering over what must be some sort of an incident. 5 years from now, you can probably imagine that in addition to helicopters with people in them, you might have drones flying around a few hundred feet above the ground taking pictures of those things. In 5 years, we also may have some of these stratospheric drones, which would be very hard to see if you're not looking for them. But if you look carefully, you'd probably see them as well. And then for people who live in areas where there are increased drone operations, for example, as I mentioned earlier, the Customs and Border Protection folks have been using drones to help patrol the border. Those drones would be visible from quite a long distance away inside the United States, and one can assume that those drones will probably be used more frequently in the future and will be seen more as well.
So you're saying by the fall of 2015, there's supposed to be an integration of commercial drone use into airspace. What are some of the more immediate impacts of the new language in the FAA funding bill?
Well, one of the first things it provides for is that 90 days after enactment, which turns out to be May 14th, 2012, will be 90 days after President Obama signed it into law, that is when there is a provision that allows the use of public drones or again, this is police forces and the like. And as long as those drones are 4.4 pounds or less to be operated within line of sight of the operator, less than 400 feet above the ground and during daylight. And there are a few other conditions. So as of or after May 14th, 2012, we can expect that there will be an increasing number of police agencies and the like operating drones according to those constraints. In addition, by November 10th of this year, that's the date when the FAA is supposed to come up with a plan that will talk in detail about how drones, and in particular civil unmanned aircraft systems, in other words, drones that aren't operated by police agencies and the like, will be integrated into the National Aerospace System no later than September 30th of 2015. So there will certainly be a lot of interest come November of this year in the details of that plan.
Well, John Villasenor, it's been really interesting. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thanks very much.
John Villasenor is a senior fellow at the Center for Technology Innovation at the Brookings Institution. He spoke with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies last week. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Sheehan. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Fred Snyder. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Melody Kramer is our associate producer for online media. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bianculli.